KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
On To the Point, we try to make sense of the policy debates and the political sideshows on the campaign trail.
You have this kind of asymmetrical warfare coming from a guy who's great at a soundbite, lousy at an answer.
So are you looking for your own billionaire?
Nope. No, I don't want my own billionaire. I'm going to raise the vast majority of the money.
Brace yourself, America, for what?
King Trump.
I'm Warren Olney. To the Point has you covered for the 2016 campaign. Find the To the Point podcast on KCRW's iTunes page.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
My intention with this film is to do something very different, something positive, you know, to share a positive experience, but by doing it in a faithful cinema verite film, and you're free to think what you want.
Award-winning documentarian Joe Berlinger's newest film, Tony Robbins, I Am Not Your Guru, provides a look inside a week-long seminar run by the polarizing self-help mogul. Critics say Berlinger should have taken a more skeptical approach, but Berlinger says that was never part of the plan. Maybe the problem is, Berlinger admits, he kind of drank that Robbins Kool-Aid himself. But first on the Hollywood News Banter, turns out the Wolf of Wall Street cast Leo DiCaprio in a real-life multi-billion dollar scandal. Stay tuned, it's The Business from KCRW. I am joined by my partner in banter, Matt Bellany of The Hollywood Reporter. Hello, Matt.
Hi there.
So, big scandal. To the surprise, I think, of possibly not that many in Hollywood, Red Granite is this production company. As you know, it was the company behind Leo DiCaprio's Wolf of Wall Street. And Red Granite showed up in town sort of somewhat out of nowhere. A guy from Kentucky named Joey McFarland and a partner named Riza Aziz, who is the stepson of the Prime Minister of Malaysia. They came in and financed this very expensive movie, The Wolf of Wall Street, $100 million. Very risky movie. Turned out that it did very well. But, you know, this kind of Martin Scorsese-directed, not comic book, not franchise movie, huge risk. Here is this company spending money like water, financing this film. These guys, especially this Riza Aziz, partying like crazy with Leo DiCaprio. And now it turns out that the federal government is alleging that this was done with ill-gotten gains, basically stolen from Malaysia.
Yeah, I mean, basically what the Attorney General is alleging is that Red Granite was part of an elaborate money laundering scheme that originated in Malaysia and was part of this fund called 1MDB. And it basically existed to take money, launder it, and spend it lavishly on apartments in New York, a home in L.A., this Red Granite production company. And the government says they want the assets. And that includes the rights to Wolf of Wall Street.
Now, Leo DiCaprio is not mentioned by name in all of this. He's referred to as Hollywood Actor One or some such thing.
But basically he is. I mean, they refer to a Golden Globe speech that the actor gave when he won, which basically means Leo DiCaprio because he won a Golden Globe for Wolf of Wall Street.
And he thanked all of these guys when he went up on stage. Now, among the money, the significant amounts of money that went to various places, millions went to Martin Scorsese's company. $48 million went to the movie's payroll company. This is Wolf of Wall Street. $2.5 million to SAG-AFTRA. And it is also reported that the Hollywood actor, who appears to be Leo DiCaprio, was part of a $1 million gambling binge at the Venetian in Las Vegas. And that is only a small fragment of the partying that went on everywhere from Cannes to New York beyond. As I said at the beginning, this is sort of a thing where you sometimes see, look, these movies are not easy to finance these days. And Hollywood has always had a very hearty appetite for money, oftentimes not scrutinizing too carefully where that money comes from. And those of us in the industry look at certain companies and say, you know, this doesn't make sense on paper. I can't really figure it out. They're spending this. They seem to be getting this back. It doesn't make a ton of sense. But you need subpoena power, like the power of the federal government, to really figure out the complex transactions that go on behind the scenes in some of these cases. And this is a classic example.
Yeah, I think it's happening more because the studios are looking to offload risk to other outside people for these very expensive non-franchise movies. The question here is, what is going to be the role going forward for DiCaprio, for Paramount, which released the film, for some of the other producers on the film? I mean, I would not be surprised if the federal government would like to interview Leonardo DiCaprio and ask what was going on, what he knew. Did he ask questions? You know, where are these millions of dollars coming from? And especially Paramount. Paramount, you know, did a very nice job marketing this film, but this was a film that was fully financed outside the company. And did they ask the right questions? Did they know where it was coming from? I mean, these are questions I think the federal government. Yeah, did they care? I mean, that movie did very well for them, and they got a nice distribution fee and won some Oscars. So the question is what the repercussions are going to be.
Yeah, we should note none of these people, not Scorsese, DiCaprio, Paramount, nobody's been accused of anything wrong at this point, but I would imagine the feds will want to talk to all of them if they haven't done already. I want to turn just to something that did not work out for Lionsgate. Lionsgate was kind of trying to clearly to do a version of The Hunger Games, which was hugely successful for them. And, you know, the irony of success is you have to keep it up. And Hunger Games ran its course. So Lionsgate made these Divergent series of movies that were going to do four movies with a big cast, including Shailene Woodley and Miles Teller and others. This series did not do nearly as well as The Hunger Games, and that's created sort of an interesting problem for Lionsgate.
Yeah, the last film in the series made just $66 million domestic, which is not what Lionsgate wanted. So they're faced with the prospect of doing a fourth movie and no one going to see it. So what did they do? They said, oh, you know, we're going to turn this franchise from a film franchise into a TV franchise. They have transferred the production over to Lionsgate TV. They have decided they're going to make a two-hour TV movie and then try to launch a series off of that TV movie at some network to be named later. The question is, will the stars of this movie sign on for a dramatically downsized TV version of the film? And my guess is no. You know, Shailene Woodley and Miles Teller and Kate Winslet, Jeff Daniels, I just don't see them going along with this unless Lionsgate TV can cough up the star salaries for this TV movie, which I don't think they're going to want to do because the whole point is to do it cheaper.
Yeah, I don't see why they would do that. I mean, no TV network would spend on the order of magnitude. I think it's going to be interesting what their contracts even say.
The contracts for the stars all specify theatrical release.
So they have an out, yeah.
The contracts have to be renegotiated. And so that essentially gives them all an out. They can leave if they want. Now, the only savior I see in this situation is if Lionsgate can somehow convince a Netflix or an Amazon to write an insane check and say, you know what, pay us $50 million, pay us $30 million, something like that. We can pay the whole cast what their fees are. We'll do it for Netflix, and then they'll try to plant people into the movies to launch a TV series after that. Maybe that makes sense, but, you know, there's no script. I don't think, you know, these actors have choices. I mean, Shailene Woodley is in the Snowden movie. Miles Teller has a lot of stuff going on. You know, Ansel Elgort as well. I just don't see this coming together with this cast.
Yeah, we will not hold our breath. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
That's Matt Bellany, executive editor of The Hollywood Reporter. Joe Berlinger is a veteran documentarian who's been through a lot in his 25-year career, so he has a lot to say on a lot of topics. His latest movie, Tony Robbins, I Am Not Your Guru, now on Netflix, and much, much more. When he joined us in the studio, we started by talking about the 1992 film that kicked off his career. Brothers Keeper traced the aftermath of the alleged murder of William Ward, one of four brothers, all unmarried and with no formal education, who lived together in a tiny shack in the village of Munnsville, New York. Berlinger's film included clips from the trial of accused brother Delbert Ward, including an occasion on which the prosecutor asked the illiterate Delbert to read.
You can't read any of that?
No.
Not at all?
No.
You didn't bring your glasses?
No, I didn't bring them. There's no good anyway.
Berlinger and his sometime collaborator, the late Bruce Sanofsky, were inspired to take a fly-on-the-wall approach for Brothers Keeper and other films thanks to their training with the Maisels brothers, the famed documentarians behind films including Gimme Shelter and Grey Gardens.
you know, just to use nonfiction as a storytelling device had kind of fallen out of favor, you know, that great 60s tradition of cinema verite. And we just wanted to make one of those kinds of films, and it cost a lot of dough. And so we maxed out a dozen credit cards, second mortgages on our home. I remember one moment where I knew that the woman that I has now been my wife for 25 years was the woman for me, because I had a refrigerator full of 16 millimeter shot film for Brothers Keeper, but it wasn't processed because we couldn't afford to process it. So I opened the refrigerator one day and I turned to my fiance. I said, Lauren, you know, we can either go on our honeymoon because we were about to get married, or I can process this footage. And I'm not, it's not a loaded question. I'm really torn. What should we do? And without skipping a beat, she said, we can always go on a honeymoon, go process that footage.
You got to marry that woman.
And I said that I knew I was on the right, I was on the right track. And the film went to Sundance. You know, we won the audience award. And the year before, Michael Moore had sold Roger and Me for $3 million. So we thought, oh, great. You know, I mean, we're going to make a sale. This is fantastic. And I went into, I wouldn't say arrogant, that's not the right word, I guess, you know, overly confident that we were going to make a sale at Sundance because Michael Moore had just sold his film and we're a documentary. But even though the reaction to the film was extremely positive, you know, all the distributors one by one said, you know, there's no way anyone's going to want to see a film about these crusty old farm brothers who don't change their clothes and, you know, all live in the same bed together. And so nobody wanted the film, so Bruce and I decided to self-distribute it. And that was a crazy idea, but, you know, I had a marketing background and I just believed in this film, as did he. So we took a year out of our lives and distributed the film, literally created the trailer, created the poster, schlepped the print from theater to theater, and the film ended up grossing like $2 million worldwide. We paid back all of our debts, and it kind of set us on our way. So that was a crazy financial adventure that ended up a happy story. And I learned a lot about the distribution business. It gave me some knowledge that has really helped me throughout my career.
This is volume one of the multi-volume Joe Berlinger story. I want to just I'll jump ahead to Crude.
Yeah.
You know, this is a doc where you ended up going into the jungle, basically, and shooting this struggle by these indigenous peoples who had their world completely polluted by, well, originally it was Texaco, I think, but that was acquired and became
Chevron bought Texaco, but
But the point I want to get to is, again, sticking for a moment with this theme of money.
Yeah.
You went through, you know, the seventh circle of hell. You shot, you know, it seems to me what you did is you went down there, you didn't have a deal or you didn't have financing, you just decided to shoot.
Right.
And what happens is that you get amazing access as the plus side.
Yeah.
And the downside is Chevron then subsequently comes after you because you had this footage of tremendous access to these people as they strategized what they were doing with their lawsuit against Chevron.
Right.
And they felt that you had this amazing access and that you had sort of sacrificed your status as a journalist, which would have protected footage.
That's what the court ruled. Our corporately inclined courts had decided that I had not functioned as a journalist, which is, you know, nonsense. But I think you're condensing time a little bit more than it should be. I mean, first of all, it's interesting that you raise Crude as a film that I started to finance myself because after the Brothers Keeper experience where we really gambled everything, I said to myself, I will never make a film without financing again until Crude, which just moved my heart. You know, Stephen Donziger, the lawyer for the indigenous plaintiffs, came to my office and told me about this horrible cancer death zone the size of Rhode Island due to irresponsible oil drilling directly into the Amazon, you know, the headwaters of the Amazon. You know, I thought to myself, no one's going to pay for a film in Ecuador, largely in Spanish and Quechua, you know, the local language. You know, I just kept resisting the idea. He said, look, just come down and see the area. And I said, look, I'll come down, but I can't promise you that I'm going to make this film. But if you want to take me down, I'll go down. And so, you know, the moment I stepped into this polluted environment, you're supposed to be in this natural, beautiful Amazon rainforest. And I just was just shocked at the devastation. So I got home to my, you know, relatively affluent environment in an hour north of Manhattan, took a drink of water from my tap water that I had heretofore taken for granted. I tucked my child into bed and I thought to myself, you know what, I have a responsibility to tell this story and I'm financially secure enough that I can tell this story. So I went ahead and shot it. And Chevron had its point of view in the film. I think the film was incredibly balanced. The film came and went. It wasn't until Chevron changed law firms, hired this scorched earth firm, Gibson Dunn, and they changed their strategy and they went after everybody.
They went after your footage.
Yeah, they went after my footage long after the film had ceased distribution. So I was issued a subpoena to turn over my footage. So the film was, I wasn't being sued for libel or defamation or
right,
anything like that.
Right, they wanted to, I'm trying to remember, there was one particular thing that wasn't in the film that you had filmed. Like,
I mean, basically they wanted to show that the independent expert that was supposed to be passing judgment
right,
on the case.
Right, he had met with this truck,
that they had
people
met,
previously.
That they had met illegally and that Donziger was illegally influencing the case. And it's a very complicated story. I fought, you know, I could have just turned the footage over, but I felt I had a responsibility not just to the subjects of my film, but to my profession.
I completely understand why you wouldn't want to do that. Now, there was a quote that you said subsequently that this experience, you were whacked over the head with a 2x4 financially, emotionally, philosophically, questioning whether it was a good or bad thing that you made Crude. This cost you over $1 million defend, right?
You know, the movie Crude cost $1.2 million and Crude, the lawsuit, cost $1.3 million. Now, luckily, that wasn't all money that came out of my pocket, but for a while, it was really scary. There was a period of time where we felt our phones were being tapped. There was a period of time where every time my child got off the school bus and my wife was meeting my child at the school bus, you know, a private eye would pull up and start taking pictures of my wife and kid for a period of months, not because they needed pictures of my kid. They just wanted to intimidate us.
Of course.
And they wanted to intimidate us financially by throwing other things at us. And on top of it, shortly after the lawsuit began, my E&O carrier, my errors and omissions insurance company that I had been paying lots of money each year to for precisely this kind of event that had never happened to me before, told me that they don't cover subpoena battles. And they said our subpoena coverage is only for compliance with a subpoena, not resisting a subpoena. Mm. And so so simultaneously, while being sued by, you know, one of the largest corporations in America for access to my footage, I had to initiate a lawsuit against my E&O company to try to
ensure.
And eventually, because of support, we were talking about Norman Lear before we came on, but because of support from people like Norman Lear and Robert Redford and, you know, just kind of industry kind of rallied behind me, you know, there was pressure put on the insurance company to settle. So I didn't get dollar for dollar, but there was a settlement. Luckily, I have some friends in rock and roll like Metallica and Sting. They were horrified at what was going on. So they made contributions. In the end, it probably cost me like $200,000, which is, you know, that's 4 years of a college education. And I had young children at home and it was, you know.
We'll stipulate that it was absolutely terrible for you. But what did you learn?
By the end of it, I was quite devastated. And I remember I was sitting, the action was still ongoing, and I was sitting at my kitchen table writing some very big checks. I was writing a big check to the law firm that had started the case, but I felt was doing a bad job. So they were getting, you know, a settled amount of money. I was hiring a new hotshot First Amendment lawyer that was taking over the case, but they wanted a retainer. And I turned to my wife, the same wife who I opened the refrigerator door and said, let's process these dailies. I said, you know, and this is now 20 years later, I said, Lauren, you know, if things don't change, if the ship doesn't change direction, we could lose everything. It was scary. A year to the day that I said that to my wife, I got word that the West Memphis Three were being released from prison on this Alford plea. And so there was something very poetic and restorative about that because
you had made the documentaries about their Paradise Lost.
Yeah, the Paradise Lost trilogy. And so the Crude experience made me wonder if I could ever make these kinds of films again because of the corporate tilt of our courts and the expense and the precedent that this case might set for future filmmakers having to turn footage over and how it would scare whistleblowers. But my faith in what I do and what gave me the courage to go back into the fray was the fact that the Paradise Lost films actually got, you know, and the activism of many people. I don't want to just say the films did it, but the films were the catalyst for a lot of activists to finally get, you know, the West Memphis 3 out of prison, and a death sentence vacated and two life without parole sentences eliminated. And that restored my faith in what I did, and I kind of dived back into it.
Coming up after a short break, Joe Berlinger tells us how he ended up at a Tony Robbins seminar in the first place and responds to the criticism of his newest film. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
Select sessions from KCRW's music program Morning Becomes Eclectic can be experienced in the immersive world of virtual reality. Download KCRW's VR app to get lost in the music. Go to kcrw.com/VR.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. We're talking to documentarian Joe Berlinger. His newest film is Tony Robbins, I Am Not Your Guru. The film immerses the viewer in the motivational mogul's flagship seminar, Date with Destiny. Some 2,500 attendees pay $5,000 each to spend a week during which Robbins works to whip them into better spiritual shape.
Welcome to Date with Destiny 2014, and for some of you, welcome home. Start your morning here this afternoon out with 12 good morning high fives, hugs. Go for it. Introduce yourself. Connect.
Though Berlinger doesn't say so in the film, he became interested in the subject matter after reluctantly attending a previous such seminar at Robbins's invitation and found himself having what he describes as a transformative experience. That aspect of the story has helped spark the criticism that has been leveled at the film that Berlinger did not take a truly objective look at his subject. It's not a stretch to say the roots of this newest movie can be traced back to an earlier project, Berlinger's 2004 doc, Metallica, Some Kind of Monster. Berlinger found himself filming the band members as they went through counseling in an attempt to stay together. This came as Berlinger was on the outs with his collaborator, Bruce Sinofsky, and the project turned into a kind of therapy for the two of them.
This was the vehicle for us to heal our relationship, and listening to the therapy, the two of us together, just caused us to go back to our hotel room at night and kind of work through our issues. And it was good because we had grown up together with Brother's Keeper and Paradise Lost, with the two of us joined at the hip and not able to pursue separate things. And by going through this process with Metallica, we figured out a way forward in which we could still be collaborators and have a healthy friendship and a healthy collaboration when it made sense, but also do our own separate projects. And it was a real breakthrough for us. And the film was, you know, transformative for our relationship and allowed us to get back, most importantly, to being best friends and then also to be occasional collaborators.
I know you didn't want to go to the Tony Robbins seminar. I don't know. I'm not even sure who encouraged you to go.
Do you want me to tell you?
Sure.
It's part of the story. And it's connected to Metallica, interesting. But, you know, I met Tony Robbins socially, and Tony was fascinated by the Metallica film. And I think he sensed that there were some issues going on in my life. I was turning 50, and I had some issues to deal with, including the illness of Bruce Sinofsky. He was getting quite ill, and that was weighing heavily on my heart. And the film is dedicated to Bruce, the Tony Robbins film. And he invited me to go to one of these seminars. In 2012, I would have told you, I'm not a seminar guy. I'm not a self-help guy. You know, but something was pulling me there. And I went, and the first 2 hours just drove me nuts. There was music, dancing, pairing off with a stranger, starting to reveal your innermost feelings. All of my red flags were going off, and I fled for the exit doors. Called my wife, again, Lauren, who's always, you know, there for
with
the right advice. So I called Lauren and I said, you know, what's my exit strategy here? I don't want to insult the guy, but I can't bear to stay here. And she said, well, you've carved the 6 days out of your life. Give it another 24 hours and see what happens. So on day two, there was this incredibly moving, transformative experience that I went through. And it's difficult to explain in a few short words, but there's a particular exercise. It's a guided memory process. And I opened my eyes. I was flooded in tears. I had a profoundly moving experience. And I stuck it out for 6 days. And I reached out to Tony afterwards and thanked him profusely. And then I, thinking he'd be totally into it, I said, hey, you know, let's make a film about this. And initially his reaction was, you know, was no, you know, and it took me 2 years to convince him to do it. But eventually he relented.
Why?
He relented because I kept after him and I provided answers to his two concerns. His one concern was that he felt that documentary filmmakers, you know, would interfere with the attendees' experience. And I didn't quite have an answer for him other than to say I've dropped into situations all the time and don't affect the outcome. You know, I called him every couple of months, and finally, with 6 weeks to go to the 2014 event, I said, look, let me come. I guess it's your theme of money again. I said, look, you know, because originally I wanted him to give me unfettered access and to state it, you know, so I could prove that I had access. So then I would go out and raise money. And he says, look, I can't give you that access because I'm not sure I'm comfortable with this, you know, and his concerns about it being an intrusion into the attendees' experience. So I said, look, I'll take the risk myself. I will come with my crew. I won't pre-sell it. And at any moment that you feel I'm disturbing your event and changing the experience for your attendees, just pull the plug. I'll give you the footage to use for coaching purposes, but I believe you will never pull the plug on me once I start because I know how to integrate into an event. And so I won him over on that. The other big issue was he was concerned that it's a 72-hour, very content-rich event, and how can you
condense it.
How can you condense it without trivializing it? And that was just an education process about the nature of documentary. So I gave him not just mine, but I gave him films to watch. And I said, look, it's the documentarian's job to condense time, but still capture the emotional truthfulness of an event. You know,
you have taken a certain amount of blowback because you weren't critical of him.
Yeah.
And you acknowledged, I kind of, a little glib phrase, but I drank the Kool-Aid at this thing. And, you know, Tony is physically a huge target, but also very wealthy. And all of that seems to conspire to me to people being annoyed with you for not burrowing into the dark side of Tony Robbins.
Yeah, no, it's a great point. And my mind is boggled by that criticism because I view the film as classic cinema verite.
I have to agree. I will say, I will interject that I did not feel like I was compelled to admire Tony
Robbins
watching
I mean, that's
the
thing that drives me crazy. You know, I faithfully recreated what it's like to be at that event.
Yeah,
and
it's a pure verite.
It's pure verite.
And you see, I mean, behind the scenes, they're bringing up the music at emotional moments.
I mean,
and you can see that there's stagecraft in the Tony Robbins
experience. I go out of my way to show that it's a manufactured event. I go out of my way to show his wealth. And it's up to you. Who am I to tell people what to think? It's a pure verite film where you're dropped into that world. And frankly, I think it's one of the most objective films I've ever made. So the criticism, I think, is coming from a different place. First of all, there's a lot of baggage associated with the self-help industry. And I think a lot of people have a particular problem with this subject matter. And so there must be a dark side or he must be a fraud. But that's not this film. It's not a compare and contrast of modalities. But I think there's something else going on in documentary. I think over the last decade or so, documentaries have become synonymous with investigative takedown pieces, exposing the latest social ill. And that's what documentary has become in people's minds. Now, I'm not knocking it because I've made many of those films. I'm not knocking it because I think it's very important. But that's not my intention with this film. My intention with this film is to do something very different, something positive, to share a positive experience, but by doing it in a faithful cinema verite film, and you're free to think what you want.
Well, I mean, I think that maybe the problem is to say that it's a positive experience. If you didn't say it was a positive experience and let people reach their own judgment, then
they wouldn't jump on you.
Well,
you're interviewing me, so I'm saying it's a positive experience, but the film itself does not say Joe Berlinger had a positive. In fact, I've been criticized.
The film doesn't, yeah.
I've been criticized. Why didn't you mention that you took it in 2012? Why is it just in your press notes?
But I'm just going to go back to you. What you said was that you wanted people to come to an acceptance of that this is a good thing.
Whether they sign up for Tony Robbins seminars or not, I could care less. I mean, as a human being, I could care because I think some people will get something out of it as I did. But my motivation for making the film is I want people to spend 2 hours thinking about the direction and quality of their own lives, thinking about how they can feel more connected and more fulfilled as a human being and how they can be more connected to one another. Because frankly, we live in very divisive times. And I know this sounds Pollyannish and overly simplistic, but I just feel like if people were more content with the direction of their own life and more connected to other people, maybe there'd be a little less strife in the world. So I wanted to do something positive. And some people are going to hate this movie and some people are going to respond to it. But it, to me, it's an incredibly objective film that just drops you into a world and lets you make your own mind up.
Joe Berlinger is the director of Tony Robbins, I'm Not Your Guru. Thanks for coming.
Thanks for having me.
And that's The Business. Caitlin Parker produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. You can hear The Business on demand with the KCRW smartphone app and get the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you download podcasts. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.
KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.